So as many of you who've been coming here regularly know, that I do take suggestions for the Friday night talk. And many of those suggestions come over the emails and internets and stuff. And the question I'm going to be focusing this talk on this evening is a fellow who listens in from Singapore on a YouTube. Who he says he works in banking and he's wondering whether he should change his job, whether he should go and live in the countryside where there's peace and serenity, or whether he should try and become self-sufficient so he doesn't need to work so hard. What should he do? So I'm going to just weave a little talk over about those questions. Now, first of all, just because you work in banking doesn't mean you're a bad person. My brother worked in banking all his life, and he did a lot of good work helping other people start their businesses. He was a good man, and he's my brother, so I love him, and he's kind. So it's not just the job you do. If you're a lawyer, some people, you know, it's almost they don't want to admit they're a lawyer. It's almost like saying they're a prostitute. Lawyers are okay. Nothing wrong with them. And so sometimes that people have these professions, and they feel guilty about them. So you don't need to do that at all. Even politicians are okay. Why are you laughing? It's interesting. I was just telling this to a few people. You know these talks which are here on a Friday night? You wouldn't believe just how far they go out into the community. Because last Sunday I was at a Thai celebration of the full moon in November. They do. It's actually a Hindu celebration which they've taken over in Thailand. Of floating these little boats in the river, Loy Krathong it's called. And of course we had the local politicians come along. I gave a little chant and then the local member for Perth, you know, Elena Evangelini came along and she gave her speech. And this is exactly what she said. She said, oh, I just heard from a wise person somewhere that, you know, you don't have to be stressed out. She said, because the only reason you get stressed out is because sometimes you hold out a cup of water and you don't know how to put it down. That's the only reason for stress. And if you've been coming here more than a couple of weeks, you know exactly where that story comes from. That is an original Ajahn Brahm. It's great, we're getting out there into the world of politics. Now that actual story is on the Harvard Business School blog. So that's actually how far these teachings actually go, you know, from this place here in Nolamara. So it actually helps people. And it doesn't really matter whether you're a banker, whether you're a lawyer, a politician, a monk, a nun, just a housewife, or it's not just a housewife, the amazing thing about looking after kids or whatever. It doesn't really matter the job you do in life. Because it's always the case that we look at somebody else's job, as I was saying last week, think, oh, it would be much better if I could be in that job. That would be so much more meaningful for me if I could, like, work for Médecins Sans Frontières and actually solve all the problems with, you know, people in dire need, or I go to the Philippines and help out with the reconstruction after the earthquake. Not the earthquakes, the floods there, the typhoon. I know that sometimes we always think that the next job will be much better than the one we have now. Now that is the most important thing to check up on, because that is the biggest mistake of your life. Thinking the other job will be so much better than the one that I am doing now. Because there's I think I mentioned this in brief last week, there's a basic principle in Buddhism, which is that if you change your jobs, if you change your place, if you change your marital status, all you're really doing is changing one form of suffering for another form of suffering. That's all it is. Now, I don't know if there's any people in year 12, they shouldn't be here this time, they should be down in Dunsborough doing a school or whatever. But you know what it's like? Do you remember when you just finish year 12 and you're about to go to university? School is finished at last. Yes, this is great. This is wonderful. And in a couple of months later, they're slogging away at university. So all you're doing, kids, is you're getting rid of school suffering. You don't have any school suffering anymore. Now you have university suffering. And what do? University, those people at university, they work really hard. They've graduated. You've seen all this. I don't know what they do. They throw their hats up into the air. And they think, yes, I'm graduated. Yes, no more university suffering. What do you have next? Work suffering, going to job Monday morning, having a boss, having to work even much harder. Have you ever noticed in life, all the things we dream, now this is over, now I'll be happy. You'll find it's just another form of suffering. So I always like to say that with people. Now, this is an old story, but about the two sisters. Probably told this last week, did I? Well, okay, so anyway, you're going to get it again. The trouble when I'm an old monk, I don't remember what I said last week. That's why I always say that I like teaching old people. You know why I like old people in the audience? Because they can't remember the joke I told them the week before. And they laugh again. It's really good. But anyway, this is a true story. Years ago, two sisters came and they wanted some counseling. The first sister, older sister, had husband trouble. Now, I think many of you know that. Many of you wives, you know what it's like having a husband. It's not easy. And you can relate to this. And there's lots of things as a monk you can do. Counsel them, try and get them to sort of work it out or whatever. She had the husband suffering. And then when I finished with her younger sister, what's your problem? And you know, she was one of these women who just couldn't have a lasting relationship. She'd find a nice guy, 1 month, 2 months, and it would always break up. And this was happening so often in her life, she was really concerned that something wrong here. You know, that she was a person who could never find a partner in life. And of course, you know, you've heard this story before. The obvious solution to the problem. And you know it. So her elder sister had a husband she didn't want, and the younger one wanted one. And her sisters, you know, you share, swap. It's obvious to me as a monk, you know, all the boys are the same, so, you know, you just trade it in. You know, if you've got an old car, you know, you don't sort of throw it away when you got it, you just give it to somebody else. They're happy, they've got a... But of course, you know, after the joking around and fun and games, I love fun and games. When people are really serious, I can't do serious sometimes. And people say, look, this is serious, Ajahn Brahm. Someone's committed suicide. And so it's very hard to do serious all the time. But anyway, sometimes it's very nice because sometimes where everyone else is, you know, thinking this is the end of the world, to me, you know, commit suicide, it's not the end of the world, it's the beginning of another life. Reincarnation. It's not the end of the world. So anyway, let's go back to this problem. So I said, the elder sister, you've got husband suffering. If you get rid of your husband, if you divorce him, run away, whatever, you won't have that suffering anymore. You'll have what your sister has. Single woman suffering. Exactly. And all you single women looking for a partner, when you find a partner in life, you won't have your single woman suffering anymore. You know what you get? Husband suffering. So they said, okay, we've got a solution. They said, we'll become nuns. It's true. If you become a nun, you haven't got single woman suffering. You haven't got married woman suffering. You know what you got? Nun suffering. Yes. Doesn't matter. You change your job. So you're a banker. You're a banker and you just go and work for Oxfam. You don't have bankers suffering anymore. You know, you have charity workers suffering. You go and talk to someone who works in an industry. You know, that's the suffering you get. So the important part of this is just changing your job will not change the most important thing, which is the attitude you have to what you're doing. And that is such an important thing that doesn't matter what job you have. I know some great lawyers, really kind, really serving. I know some great politicians who are really trying to do their best for the community. You know, these are the ones who are just elected. After a while, they're just... But there are some really nice ones around. There are nice husbands, there are nice wives, there are nice nuns. They're trying to do their very best. Now, that's the most important thing to remember. Whatever job you have in life, whatever role you have in life, you belong in this life. You know, we do need you. You're really important. And it's how you do your job is what is the cause of happiness and fulfillment, not the job itself. There was one fellow who used to come here, and he was really depressed because he said, you know, all I am is a bus driver. You know, driving one of these buses, you know, for the people of Perth. And he said, that's just such a low job. I'm not really doing anything with my life, just driving a bus all day. And I actually convinced him, said, no, you're doing an amazing service. And it's how you drive that bus. You get these passengers coming on, just, you know, saying, good morning, how are you? Are you, you know, having a lovely day today? You know, just going that little bit of an extra, or a smile when it's a hot day and people have just got all their shopping, and just giving them a hand, or just asking them, just, you know, just to take your time. You know, it doesn't really matter. Those little acts of kindness which you see, you know, just on a bus driver, doesn't that change your day? I will never remember this. I was being driven, I was just teaching over in England, being driven to the airport in Heathrow early one morning. And there was one of these, the children's school crossing attendants. You know, over here they got these flags. Over in UK they have these little signs. And they're called lollipop ladies because they've got these big sort of red signs on the end of a stick. And this, you know, lollipop lady, she must have been in her 60s at least, because they're usually retired people. She was rapping on the, you know, doing the rap as she was taking the kids off. And I've never seen anything like it in my life. I don't know if she was on some drugs or whatever, but she was really weird, and she had everybody laughing on the way to work. It would have made an excellent video if I ever had a mobile phone, which I don't, because I don't know how to use it. I keep pressing the delete button anyway. But it would have been a wonderful movie, because it was just made everybody so happy. A simple job like that. It's amazing just what you can do to create happiness and joy, meaning, kindness in this world. It's not your job. If you're a banker, it's how you do that banking. That is what is the most important part of life. The job itself, okay, you may think, I'm a banker, you know, or I'm a brain surgeon. I told that joke last week, the brain surgeon and the rocket scientist joke. But it doesn't matter what you're doing, it's how you do it. That's the most important thing in life. So you don't need to change your job. You know, stay as a banker, whoever wrote that thing in Singapore. You have to do it, but how you do it, you can put a lot of happiness. And even if the job itself, you know, it doesn't really give rise to much happiness, just messing around on a computer all day, still, you know, you do meet people. You do go up and down in the elevator in your office. You do see people on the way to work. You meet so many people, even when you have your lunch. Just all those interactions. That is where life is actually happening. And there you can always give some compassion, some kindness, some joy in your life. And it means so much to people. Small things mean a huge amount. I told the monks that one of the last times I was traveling over in, you know, overseas, I think I was going to Malaysia, just passing through Changi Airport, usually go through Singapore and go through the airport, and I saw this Western lady. She was laying down trying to get some sleep on a couch. And it was just, you know, maybe 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning. She was having a really hard time. And I had a pair of these eye shades from the airline. They'd given it to me the night before. And I didn't need them anymore. I just stopped and said, "Would you like to have some eye shades, madam?" And she just couldn't believe it. Someone was being kind in an airport when everyone is supposed to just ignore each other. And I just gave her these eye shades so she could put them on and get a couple of hours sleep. What a wonderful gift that is. And, you know, I keep remembering that, even though it's now 2 or 3 months ago. It always gives me lots of happiness. It gave her happiness. Simple things like that you can do wherever you are in your life make all the difference in the world. So don't have to change your job, but change the way you do your job. Change the way you relate to your job. And then you don't have to move out into the country. I don't know why people want to move out into the country. I live in the country. Look, this is what the country is like. hundreds more flies than you have in Perth, ticks, which crawl all over you, and when you get them on there, they really itch for days. Just a week ago, I went to New South Wales, to Santi Monastery, to help out over there. And you think it's peaceful? The cicadas were so loud. It was much louder than staying sort of, you know, just next to the airport with the 747s, whatever they have, going over there. It was so loud, you had to put your hands over your ears. Sometimes the forest is the noisiest place in the world with all these animals. And you know, half the animals there, they look at you as their dinner. That's what happened in Thailand. In Thailand, there were snakes out there, centipedes, ants. When they saw a toad, they didn't have much good vision. The ants, they saw a toad, they thought that was a nice fat worm, which they wanted to eat for their lunch. So there were so many animals and stuff in there. It was just, you were just so happy to get to the city. And in the city, it was nice and cool. And you didn't have all these bugs, you know, and mosquitoes, and these sand flies, and these, what are the other, march flies. You know, just, you know, how much they hurt. And they're all in the forest. You don't have them over here. Do you like to live close to nature? Bushfires, cyclones. It's wonderful in the city. That's why when I'm in the forest, I think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to retire to the city? And you think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to retire to the forest? Because we always have this dream that, you know, that, sure, if you live in the forest, in the countryside, you have what? Countryside suffering. You know, it's a long way to go to the dentist or to the doctors. You know, it's just too far to go sometimes. And there's no public transport to be found. If you haven't got a car, you're stuffed. And you don't have any, if there's any sort of problems with West, what synergy it's called now. You know, we're the last person to fix the poles. You know, you guys get fixed up first of all. So the electric supply is sometimes third world in those places. So we have what's called countryside suffering. And you come to the city, of course, you don't have that anymore. You've got doctors, you've got air cons, you've got lots of electricity, public transport, everything is so close. So, yeah, you don't have countryside suffering anymore. You have city suffering. Traffic jams. You got burglars. You got, what else you got in this place? You got noise. You got neighbors. You got, I don't know what else you got, but you know what it's like. You get a different type of suffering. So don't ever think that I'm going to go to Margaret River. Because Margaret, for those on the internet over here, that is, you know, one of the desirable residents for people to retire, you know, here in Western Australia. The wine region, the beaches, the beautiful countryside, the rivers, the flies, the big mortgages and debts to buy any house over there. Whatever it is. So we always think that if we can go over there, then we'll be happy. It's not the case. You're just replacing one form of suffering for another form of suffering. So forget about it. And why not just enjoy where you are? You can always... You know, on a Friday afternoon, well, actually I came Friday morning. A lot of times I actually drive up from Serpentine up here on a Friday afternoon. It's actually brilliant because usually the roads are pretty free because everybody in Perth is going down south. You see so many people on that road, especially the long weekends. They all go down south to get away from it all. But actually they find all has all gone down south with them. It's crazy. And when I go back on a Sunday afternoon, everyone's coming back up again. I always like doing things differently than other people. You know, if people go south, I want to go north. If they go north, I want to go south. It's nice being a monk like that. I always do things different, sometimes just on purpose. Just to be different. So anyway, so what are you doing that for? And sometimes I ask you, when you have a weekend, why on earth do you have to go away for the weekend? You spent so much money on your house. You've tidied it up, made it so comfortable. Your beds are the best in the world. Your pillow, there's nothing like your pillow in your own bed. Nothing like, you know, the home food. Everything is so comfortable there. You spent so much time making it perfect. Why is it the first time you have a bit of a rest, you run away? They're absolutely crazy people. Why is it? Because we think, oh, down south or up north or out west or anywhere else is something better than my own house. Sometimes you wonder about that. Why can't you just spend the weekend in your house and just call it a holiday? Don't cook. You know, order takeaway. And I don't know. Wouldn't it be actually, it's an interesting idea for like new holidays. Have like a group of people who just come to your house and they do all the cooking and all the cleaning and they just live in a caravan outside with a button so you can have room service whenever you like. So it's like a hotel, but you know, you get the service, you get sort of in hotel, but it's your own house. You know, they actually be like in-house, your own house hotels. I said, yeah, that could actually make a bit of money out of that idea. It's amazing how many cookie ideas I get when I'm giving these talks. Really out, it's weird and strange. But, you know, some of them actually can work. So this is something we can actually do to end the problems and suffering. We can actually be in our own house instead of always thinking to go somewhere else to be the better thing. So you don't have to go down into the countryside. Just your own house, your own home, whatever it is. How about learning how to love that instead of always wanting to change it? This is the core of this talk this evening. Why can't we open the door of the house to the fact we were, open the door of our heart to the fact we were a banker, embrace it, and respect it, see all its good qualities, and make peace with it? Why can't we open the door of our heart to our own abode, whatever that happens to be, big or small? This is my home, and I love it. Instead of always trying to change it and get rid of it or make it different. Why can't we open the door of our heart to ourselves? Say, yeah, I'm a banker, I'm a politician, that's good enough. Instead of always wanting to change things. You know why we always want to change things is because, you know, we don't know how to appreciate what we have. We don't know how to appreciate our own home, our own family. We're always trying to change our kids, trying to make them smarter. They're smart enough. You know, women always trying to change their appearance, you know, trying to make themselves more beautiful. You're beautiful enough. Guys always going to the gym, trying to make themselves thinner. I don't do that. I'm beautiful enough. We're trying to change things, for goodness sake, instead of appreciate things. And because of that, we get so negative about our job, about our figure. Fat is the new sexy. I've got to be careful what I say sometimes. It used to be. Have you ever seen these old paintings, you know, in the 200 or 300 years ago? You know, all the beautiful women, they were actually fat. And somehow or other, the last 100 years, you know, anorexic women are sexy. And is it terrible what you're doing to yourselves? You know, in the old days, even if you ever seen that fat Buddha in Buddhist shops? No, that's my idol. That's what I'm trying to live up to. And the reason why it was an idol, an image, was because that was a symbol of prosperity and happiness. And I told a few people today, because this is actually the old medicine which I grew up with. If you are always worrying, angry, upset, that's when you get thin. That's my problem. For years, I've been letting go of all anxiety. I don't get anxious. I don't worry about anything. I'm so at peace. That's why it's impossible to be thin anymore. If I would worry some more, then I'd lose weight. So I need, actually, not to go to the gym. I need to go to worry school. So please teach me how to worry some more. Be more anxious. Be more anxious, and I'll start losing weight. But no, just in other words, be yourself and be happy. Someone sent me a little article. It's great when they sent me a little article over the internet. There was one lady, this was in TEDx channel. If ever you want to see some really interesting stuff, this is an internet channel which has confronting ideas. And this was one sort of psychologist, I forget who her name was, I really should have paid more attention and just to quote her. But she was actually seeing some research which was done. Just saying that stress is not the problem. It's not the cause of cardiac arrest. But how you deal with the stress. He said there's two ways of dealing with the stress of life or with the difficulties of life, with the challenges of life. You look at them as being, oh, this is too much, this is bad, with negativity. And that causes cardiac problems. the negativity which you add on to your stressful life. And the other way is look upon it as a challenge. Yeah, I can do this. This is actually pushing me. This is, as I keep on saying here, more shit from my mango tree. Yes, give me more. Then you don't get cardiac problems or any health problems. It's not how much work you do, but your attitude towards it. It's not your life changes, you know, whatever happens, you get divorced or you get a cancer or whatever. It's how you relate to that. That is the key to health, physical health. Obviously coming from mental health, first of all. And that was a fascinating piece of research which was done, and good on that lady for pointing what we know, we've known in Buddhism for centuries. The mind is the forerunner of all things. The way you have an attitude to whatever you have to deal with in life, being a banker, being a politician, that's not the cause of problems. Your attitude towards it. You know, getting divorced, having cancer, losing someone in a terrible accident or suicide, that's not the problem. It's just how you're relating to it. I look upon this as a challenge, something in life which you're going to really live up to, you know, get to understand from, learn from, grow from, become a better person from. If that's your attitude, you're going to be very healthy. And these things aren't going to bother you so much. So you don't have to go off and just run away from the problems of life, which is running away. I don't have to run off into the city to get away from the problems of living living close to nature. People always think it's the other way around, don't they? You know, run away from the city to live close to nature. For me, I like to run away from nature to live in the city because I live there. I know what it's like. People used to say that when I was in Thailand, for example. In Thailand, this was really living rough in those days. I know this, I think it was about 7 years. Now, this was real jungles 40 years ago. Real jungles, you know, real big snakes, you know, mosquitoes, the works, you know, eating disgusting food, no electricity, no dentists for miles around. No telephone anyway to actually get any ambulance. You were just totally by yourself. And after 7 years, I got permission to go and visit my family in UK. And of course, got on the cheapest possible air flight from Bangkok to London, which was, you know, very cheap economy class on Philippine Airlines. You know, and this was a long journey all the way from Bangkok to London. Economy in a cheap airline. For me, I just couldn't believe the luxury. There was no ants around, no mosquitoes in the aircraft. This was paradise. The seat actually had upholstery. I hadn't seen upholstered seat in 7 years. And there was actually food you could eat. It didn't have any bugs in it, or snails, or frogs. And when I got there, I thought, wow, if this is an economy class, first class must blow your mind. Because it was just from where I came from. It was just, you know, so rough. But you know, you get used to it after a while. And it's just the attitude you have towards where you're living. That is everything. It was okay. It was good enough. You get used to this. Other people live like that. I learned to live like that, and it was okay. The trick was not to complain or to have negativity. And that's one of the reasons why I want just a key story. This isn't the first Opening the Door of Your Heart book. There's another one out now. A key story in life. And it was when, you know, that time I was having to work really hard as a monk, you know, pushing wheelbarrows of dirt all day for 9 days. And, you know, I never became a monk to be exploited. You know, I became a monk, you know, to learn Buddhism, to learn Dharma, to meditate, all those ones, to live in solitude, not to labor on some stupid big building which the abbot wanted to construct. And he had enough money. Why didn't he get earth movers instead of making us do all this hard work? And after 7 days of that, I lost it. I started getting angry. And it's understandable, because that's not what you're supposed to. I was so dirty. He didn't have time for a bath. You know, never had much time to sleep when you're just so tired and everything was dirty. I hadn't meditated for 7 days. Because, you know, he just worked all day. And I started getting angry and upset. And when you are in a foreign country, you know, you swear in your language, hoping the locals don't understand. But they do. Even if they don't understand the words, they can see from your body language you are upset. So one of the Thai monks, one of my friends, he saw I was very angry and upset. And he came up to me and said, I forget who it was, but whoever it was, a wonderful teaching you gave me, which, you know, one of those teachings which changes your whole life. And he said, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the difficult part. And you know, sometimes they say things and you understand, the light bulb goes on, and the whole suffering disappeared. It was true. It was the thinking about it. I shouldn't be doing this. Why should I do this? This is unfair. Why me? Why do I have so much earth in this? Why is earth so heavy? Why are the wheelbarrows so old? That was the suffering part. But as soon as I stopped and just was still and peaceful and stopped complaining and stopped thinking, that wheelbarrow was really light. And I could push it and have fun with all the other monks. You know, have little races so you can get bash into one of the other monks' wheelbarrows just for fun. You know, you can start playing. We have a lot of play, you know, as a monk. That's why that many people come and see us and they don't say, you're not monks, you're just kids who haven't grown up. Yeah, fair enough. But this is just a playfulness, which is great in life. That's why, you know, I'm always try to have that playfulness when you give talks. But just that whole idea, don't just think about it, just do it. And it's easy, whatever it is in life. Be a banker, just doing it is so easy. But you think about it, you can think all the reasons why you shouldn't. You know, if you're going to get married, go and get married. Thinking about it's a hard part, doing it's really easy. Just come here, Dennis is over there, just put the rings on, you're done, it's easy. Divorce, it's easy, just do it, don't think about it. Even just often say dying. Dying is the easiest thing in the world, just stop thinking about it, just do it. And it's so true, and so much things in life, going to the dentist, going to have an operation, going to have the biopsy, going to have a mastectomy, whatever else in life, it's the thinking about it, it's a tough part. That's the problem there. So you live in a country. Living in a country is easy. Think about it as a problem. Living in the city is easy. You think about it with negativity, and then you get very depressed. That is the whole problem. The other part of the thing which she asked me in this email was about, should I just go live by myself and be self-sufficient? I know I always thought, because I come from a, you know, Western background, that when you join a monastery, the monasteries will be self-sufficient, because all the Christian monasteries were just like that. They were self-sufficient. You know, they grew all their own food. They cooked their own food. You know, they did all their own maintenance. And they did everything. But when I became a Buddhist monk, I said, no, no, that is not allowed. You cannot be self-sufficient. And that was in the rule set down by the Buddha. So much so that you have to feed us every day. You know, when I was a student, I used to bake my own bread. It was a waste of time because as soon as it was out of the oven, all the other students in the house, they appeared from nowhere and they always wanted to eat my bread. And it was my whole supply for the week. It went in a couple of hours. Because you know what it's like, you know, you smell of like warm, hot bread. It's such a delicious smell. Everyone was out there and they just, okay, guys, you take it. And I had nothing left. I had to go to the shop and buy some. But I could cook, okay? And many other monks are great cooks. Some of them are actually chefs who used to work as a cook before they became monks. But can they cook? No. We got beautiful land down in Serpentine. We could grow vegetables, grow rice, grow all sorts of stuff. Can we do that? No. Because if we did that, it would be very easy for us to become self-sufficient. And what would that be saying? We don't need you. Thank you very much. Get out of here. Nick off. We're meditating. Now, what would that feel like? Isn't there something missing there somewhere? So the Buddha actually made us deliberately dependent. And this is a beautiful thing of that man. I didn't understand it at first, but after 39 years as a monk, being deliberately dependent is a beautiful way of, number one, lessening your ego and developing this beautiful compassion. We're saying, I need you. Isn't it wonderful that there are a group of people, if you never came, we would not eat. We really need you. So people actually go to these monasteries, the monks' monastery, the nuns' monastery, because they have to, and they have so much fun doing something. It's wonderful if you're in a relationship, even if you are so smart and clever, you can do everything. Don't ever do that. Be deliberately dependent on your spouse. Even if you can do it better, say, no, I need you to do this for me. Because that is developing this beautiful compassion. Where I understood this from was an old story of His Holiness the Dalai Lama many years ago, when he was still in Tibet, apparently, and one of the first journalists who discovered this great man was actually following him when he went from town to town, village to village in Tibet to meet his people. And wherever the Dalai Lama went in Tibet, people would line up to give him things. And of course, this journalist, being a Westerner, couldn't understand why people were giving this monk who lived in a palace, had everything, so many things. And one day, in one village, this incredibly poor lady dressed in rags, it was her turn to give something to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and she gave him this old woman's skirt. At which point the journalist couldn't contain his anger any longer. He blurted out in full voice and in anger, "You call yourself a religious leader? You call yourself a holy man? You call yourself compassionate? And you take this skirt from a woman who's much more poor than you are? You can't wear a skirt. You're a man. What do you want a skirt for? She needs it more than you." Worse than that, because I haven't practiced enough getting angry, so please excuse me. I'm doing my very best. And at the end of that, when he calmed down, and this is a beautiful Buddhist way, when people get angry, you let them vent. And after they finished, pause. Don't reply straight away. It's when they call it the 30 seconds of silence after someone has shouted at you. A lot of times, as soon as they shout it, you say something back. Back. You've lost this amazing opportunity. If you're silent for 30 seconds once a person's really ranted at you, in those 30 seconds, they have an opportunity of reflecting on what they've just said and how they've said it. It's an amazing opportunity, which means the person who's got very angry at you and shouted at you can realize what a terrible thing they've just done. If you speak back to them straight away, they don't have those 30 seconds of reflection. So that's what the Dalai Lama did. That's what a lot of trained people do. Give people an opportunity to see their own anger through the 30 second of silence. And then anyway, afterwards he said, "Yeah, you're right. Always agree with people." That totally discombobulates them. I promised someone I was going to say that word. It's one of my favorite words, to discombobulate. You don't have to know what it means, it just sounds good. I said it last Wednesday. To discombobulate means actually to take away their ease, to discomfort them, to confuse them. And so this guy was totally discombobulated. You can look up, it's a real word, look up in a dictionary. Discombobulation. So he's totally discombobulated. And then the Dalai Lama continued. He said, "Yes, yeah, I agree with you. I don't need a skirt, but that woman needs to give it to me." And straight away, the journalist understood what being dependent, not being self-sufficient, is all about. Yes, the monks, the nuns, we can make our own food. We can probably cook much better than you do. At least we can cook what I like, instead of what you think I like. But that's not the point. You need to give. I need to give. That's why we are deliberately not self-sufficient. We're deliberately dependent on one another. And that gives this beautiful sense of community, interdependence, from which compassion, friendship, grow. Isn't it such a beautiful thing to depend upon someone else and for them to depend on you? But that's really important if any of you ever get sick, which you will eventually. When you really get sick, it's a wonderful thing. It's a great gift to the people who love you. Here I am, I'm sick, I need you. Isn't it wonderful to look after someone who's sick, to actually be needed? Isn't it rotten, terrible, lonely, dry, dark, when you're not needed at all? We need more people to be dependent and less people to be self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency dries up compassion in our world. So that's one of the things, the Buddha knew that, incredibly wise person. I mean, all these years I've been a Buddhist, you know, you just still keep uncovering new sort of angles on the wisdom of just what he taught. Just fascinating. The psychology, even modern psychology, can't match some of the stuff which you keep on reading and finding out. To be deliberately dependent and not self-sufficient. If you're self-sufficient, you'll be lonely. You'll not need anybody. You'll be dry. You'll have no joy, no love, no compassion. The source of this is just gone. Which is one of the reasons, just in brief, I tell people, if ever somebody, you know, you're old, and somebody says, oh, madam, can I help you across the road? Please always let them help you across the road, even if you don't want to go. And when they've gone, when they're out of sight, then you can cross back again. Of course, that's beautiful, that's life. I always tell this story, she's not here, I think she's too old now, she doesn't come anymore, I think she's a bit sort of past it. Even in the cold weather, I do not wear socks. See, I always got, so no socks on here, oops, never mind. But one Friday night, this old lady came up and said, Ajahn Brahm, I've knitted you a pair of socks just for you. And so what did I do? Do I say, no, I don't need any socks. Can't you see? Are you blind, lady? I never wear socks. Take them away. Give them somewhere else, not me. Wouldn't that be nasty? So I never did that. I said, oh, thank you so much. And I wore them. I put them on. And during the talk, I moved the thing along and I just pushed my leg out and waved it. So she could see it on purpose. And I always remember that. She was sitting over there somewhere and in the corner of my eye, she turned around to her friend and said, he's wearing my socks. He's wearing my socks. That's such a wonderful thing to do. See, I'm deliberately dependent. When you're deliberately dependent, you create so much fun and joy in life. So please never ever be self-sufficient. Always find ways of being needed and being needy. And that creates this beautiful harmony in the world. That's why, you know, we can work our butts off for you guys, you know, teaching, looking after you, helping out, whatever we can do. But when the nuns need your help, even though they can do it themselves, that's not the point. We need to share. And before I get into trouble, that even though, you know, I don't need more members, our membership secretary was saying, Ajahn Brahm, could you please get these people, many people come here and they haven't joined up, and those who have joined up have not paid their subs. It's not we need the money, it's that you need to give. Make sure, and all you people listening overseas, making good use of all these talks. You know, please get on the internet and become members of our Buddhist society and just join up. It's really important for us because you need to support and be part of this. Because whenever actually you support and you give and you're needed and you need and you're needy, it creates this sense of community. And that's one of the most important things we do here. It's not just learning how to sit here and meditate, get in line and off you go, never see you again. It's much more than that. It's this beautiful sense of friendship, community, people from so many different walks of life, different races, even different religions sometimes come here, and all working together. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Why? Because I need you. and hopefully you need me. So that's why self-sufficiency is the wrong way to go. It's impossible anyway. If you think you're self-sufficient, if you think you can go off for 6 months on an island and live as a hermit, most hermits go mad, totally crazy. I did 6 months as a hermit, and look what happened to me. No, I didn't go crazy, I could meditate. So be careful, it's nice to be with other people and be needed and to need. So that's the answer to the question from Singapore. I hope you're happy with that. Again, just your job. It's okay being a banker. Bankers rock. And you don't need to go out into the countryside. Just in your own home is more than good enough. You're just changing one form of suffering to another form of suffering. And don't be self-sufficient. Need other people and be needed. And that way you have a beautiful life of compassion, wisdom and freedom. So thank you for listening. That's the talk for this evening. Hopefully see you next week. This is Sadhu Sadhu. Many talks in a row this time. And we have the questions from overseas. And anyone from here, first of all? Any questions from our audience? We've got them. Hey. The first one is from Scarborough. That's not that overseas. But the second one is actually from Central China. So even in China, the Central China, they listen to this. From Scarborough, dear Ajahn Brahm, my question is, the bad karma we get in return when we break a precept is greater or less than breaking another precept? Thank you. In other words, can I break one precept to keep another one? What can we say there? Okay. Okay. Okay, can I, for example, can I steal to keep my wife from killing me? Is that right? I don't know. Anyway, now look, it's for the precepts always, if you can't keep five precepts, we've got the five precepts, not deliberately killing a living being, not stealing, not committing adultery, not lying, not taking alcohol or drugs. But if you can't keep the five precepts, because sometimes people can't count to five these days, it's too much. Two precepts. So I give two precepts to people who can't keep the five. And the two precepts are never do anything which causes harm to another being. And number two, never do anything which causes harm to yourself. The two precepts. Now if you can keep those two precepts, all the other precepts in the whole world will be kept. And also you understand where the precepts come from. So, you know, bad karma, you break a precept, greater or lesser. Are you doing harm? Or are you actually doing a service? Or actually lessening harm? And a good example of this, and this is a real moral dilemma, abortion. What changed my mind on this was this incredible case when I was visiting my mother in England. There was a mother, it was on the news, a mother with twins in her womb. And the medical condition was such, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not sure, the medical condition was such that if the doctor in charge aborted one of those twins, the other one would survive and so would the mother. If he did not, or she did not, don't know who the gender of the doctor was, if they did not abort that child, then both children would die and the mother would as well. And it was such a clear case, there was no problem about the, no doubt about the prognosis. All the other doctors said, yes, it was 100% certainty. If they let the sort of pregnancy continue on, the mother and the two fetuses inside would die. But if they took out one of those fetuses to aborted it, the other one would survive and so would the mother. What is a moral thing to do? I asked many people, and if you're that doctor, if you've got that duty of care, all the people I've asked, and I've asked them to put their hand up, Buddhists for years and years have said, if I was that daughter, yes, I would have bought that child. So the other child could survive and so could the mother. It was literally breaking one precept to keep two more. So two other kids, or a kid and a mother would still survive. To me, that was lessening the harm. And, of course, while many people were debating this on TV, the doctor just did abort one of the kids. So the other one could survive, and so could the mother. Now, that to me, that makes a lot of sense. Does it to you? Why? Because sometimes you get so confused with, you know, the rules. I shouldn't kill, I shouldn't do this. But a lot of time, when you make it simple, like, are you harming anybody? Are you harming yourself? And lessening the harm. And if that doesn't work, sometimes you feel it inside. And often that just, I feel these moral dilemmas. You feel, what's the right thing to do? And yeah, how you feel in your heart, what you intuit, is nearly always right. You feel it in here first of all, and then you can explain it afterwards. That's what the doctor did. And if you were in that situation, not theoretical anymore, but real, I'm sure that most of you would do that as well. So, the bad karma, and then it's not bad karma, because it's not coming from the wrong place. If it's coming out of ill will, out of personal desire, out of fear, out of stupidity, then yes, that's bad karma. You've considered it, you really think you're doing the best, the most compassionate for everybody, including yourself and all other beings, and you've really done your very best, then it is not bad karma. Okay, the second question from Central China. Ajahn, what is the significance of denouncing the world for enlightenment, like what you did? No, I didn't do that. I didn't denounce the world, I just left the world. And the world followed me. I still had a world, as a monk in Thailand, I still got a world now. So what the significance is that, you know, as a, well, for me, this is my own person, I always wanted to be a monk. This is, you know, my, I never realized it at first until I saw my first monk and said, wow, that just really sort of hit me hard. And I wanted to be a monk. I told this to you or somebody, I forget which, that when I first ordained as a monk, and that was over 39 years ago now, the first few days in this monastery in Bangkok, I woke up with nightmares, the first few nights. And this, I'm not exaggerating, I woke up in a sweat, in a nightmare, in the middle of the night. My nightmare was that I was a layman, that I wasn't a monk. And as soon as I opened my eyes, saw the robes next to me, I'm a monk. And I closed my eyes and went into a deep, comfortable sleep. And that's actually how much psychologically I really wanted to become a monk. So it was not denouncing the world. The reason why I became a monk, because I wanted to fulfill two purposes in my life. You know, as a student in Cambridge, I had a lot of time, and a lot of time to reflect, talk with your friends. What do you want to do in your life? The two things I wanted to succeed at in life was to be able to serve and create happiness for other people. To serve. And the other one I wanted was personal fulfillment as well, my own happiness. So how can I have a career, a lifestyle where I can give happiness to others and have happiness inside myself? When I saw this monastic career, this is the best. You know, you've seen me many times. You're not just sitting here. You hang out afterwards, chatted, go to a monastery, talk to me. Now, I'm a very happy monk. I'm very fulfilled. And also an incredible amount of happiness you can give to other people. Really, I can serve big time. And this is amazing fulfillment which I have as a monk. So, you know, I've met my two main criteria. Not denouncing the world, not running away from anything, but running towards things. Running towards incredible inner happiness and the ability now to share that happiness with others. That is an amazing sort of privilege which I have in my life right now. There's usually about, people tell me about 30,000 people listen to this talk on average. 30,000 people you can touch. There's some people in the hall here, you're just like the studio audience. You're great, because otherwise it would have no life to it. But you know, it's the ones outside there you're really helping. And just, you know, getting a politician to learn about stress and just spread that around. You're getting into some really great areas of life, and wonderful to be able to do that. So that's the reason why I'm a monk. It's not denouncing the world. Denouncing is too negative. It's actually reaching out for something more beautiful and fulfilling. So that's what you do. So, Lin Ju in central China please reach out for something even more beautiful, more helpful, more serving to your friends, to your family, to your nation, and to the world. For your own happiness and the happiness of all beings. That's actually why we're here. Okay, any other questions from the audience? Okay, so we'll finish now and I'll see you next week. Same place, same time. We'll now pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhāto bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi. Thank you.